Check this out.
It is time.
Check it out, y'all.
You are now about to witness.
And it goes a little something like this.
Alexander Ovechkin curl and drag to the back end. He scores! Simply sensational! Brodeur looking for the goal. Down the ice. Score! Bertrand Brodeur!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to another edition of the Game Time Decision Podcast, continuing our analytics series. I'm Colton Prill. Joining me today, it's Micah Blake McCurdy. Micah, welcome to the show.
How you doing?
I am fantastic. It is a pleasure having you on, sir. It's been a great day as far as podcast guests go. We had Manny Perry on earlier today doing your recording now. We've got Carolyn Wilkie coming up. It is an exciting time for this show and for myself because I tell you, interviewing you guys is like the most incredible learning experience as far as hockey stats go. It is just so much fun. I get so much knowledge from these. Really enjoying it. But how are you?
I'm awesome, thanks, and I'm happy to help.
Awesome. All right. If you want to find Micah, you can find him on Twitter at ineffectivemath, or you can find his website, hockeyviz.com. Let's get right into this. Micah, I start off each of these episodes with the same two questions to everybody, which are, if you had to explain to someone who is new to the community or new to this series, how would you explain where we are in terms of hockey analytics, but also with where we've been and perhaps where we're going?
So I like your question because it's very ambiguous. And especially the really tricky thing for me is who's the we that you're talking about. There's a lot of people doing a lot of work. There's a lot of audiences who take it all in at different levels. And depending on who you talk to, you'll get different answers. So I know what I'm doing already, which I guess is another way of saying already the community of people doing public analytics work is broad enough and wide enough that there's no single thing. There's no single even class of ideas that occupies all the minds of all the people. So some of the people you mentioned, Carolyn, for instance, Carolyn's been doing a lot of good work about coaching analysis and about GM analysis and about contract analysis, which is work that hasn't been done very extensively. And whereas you mentioned Manny, who doesn't do anything along those lines at all, instead he's been forging new paths towards player evaluation. And every single person brings not just different abilities, but different interests, which are, I think, even more important to the table. So where we are is at this interesting explosion point, if you like, where there's a great diversity of things going on, where we're starting to connect in different ways. So some people are moving themselves towards coaching metrics because they want to be able to connect with coaches. There's been a criticism of analytics that there's, you know, you can say, oh, well, so-and-so has great results and so-and-so has terrible results, and so you should play him instead of him. Well, that's nice for a coach, but you can't. He needs more than that. They need more than that to go on. You need to be able to say, well, we're going to go this way, or we're going to go that way, or this is why. And so if you're working from a statistical point of view, you don't have any of those mechanisms. You can be as sure as you like that your effect is real, but you still need to figure out why. So that's one of the directions we're going is towards coaching. Another direction that people are going is towards management, about towards systematics of evaluation. I mean, a lot of what passes for evaluation now is just fancy guessing, without a great deal of anything systematic. And so people starting to say, we're going to evaluate players the same way every time. That's an analytics mindset, even if you don't have the kind of precise details that we might like behind that. So that movement towards front offices is also there. And then you have another thread, which is a broader, more fan-based understanding where the websites come in, where there's people who aren't just publishing research, but there's people who are trying to say, well, this is all of the things that happened. This is a comprehensive approach. This is everything that happened for a team, everything that happened for a league, everything that happened for a season. And so my website is part of that, and Manny's website is also part of that. And one of the things that links into that is that sort of links in towards journalists, if you're looking at existing professions. So they have, because they have this mandate to take hockey to people, and they have to tell stories. And so they need to have the raw material that fits what it is they want to talk about. So there's those three strands that connect to existing jobs, that connect to coaching, that connect to general management, that connect to journalists. And I think those are the three areas that really excite my attention for where I think the community as a whole is headed soon.
Do you see a future where there might be a fourth realm, maybe for younger players in junior leagues where we're hitting not only major coaches, major GMs, people making moves, but also players themselves where they can get to a point where they're using these statistics to, to try and influence their own game.
I'm skeptical about that. It's possible, but I'm not. At least my approaches have always been so high level, if you like, that I don't see a great deal of virtue in telling players, in players having a greater awareness of the kinds of statistical techniques that are being used to evaluate them and being used to describe their play. I think you can, you know, there's value in making those connections, but I think that value is largely for coaches, not for players. And in fact, I worry not just, you know, there's some people who are uncharitable and say, oh, you know, hockey players could never understand that kind of thing, which is just nonsense. You know, anything you can explain well, and anyone who wants to understand it will understand it. But I think it may actually be counterproductive. I think it's the job of coaches, with the help of whatever analysts are around, to break down the things that lead to into the things that lead to good shifts and the things that lead to good conditioning, and communicate them to players. And I worry if there are players who focus themselves on those measures, that you'll find that the measures no longer measure what you want them to, because essentially you'll have changed the system that you're talking about by influencing it.
Who would you recommend to people who are looking to get into hockey statistics? Are there blogs that you would recommend reading? Are there people you'd recommend following on Twitter? You know, how would you recommend someone who's new to this community to really just delve into it?
So I'm a uniquely terrible choice of person to ask this question to, because I read much less than I ought to. And some of that is my own bad habits, coming from the background that I do in mathematics, where there's a very high premium placed in doing everything yourself. So I would never read somebody else's approach of something if I thought I could do it myself. Which is good in a way, because it means that I have a real breadth of stuff, but it's also bad because it means I'm disconnected from the community. So I don't read any blogs at all, but I do pay a great deal of attention to people on Twitter, and I have a community of people whose work I really respect. The three people I think who are the highest on that list are Carolyn Wilkie, for sure, who you said you were having on shortly, and that's going to be a treat for your listeners. I find her all-around work is excellent. Her instincts are fantastic. And most especially, I feel like she's doing a lot of good work with contract value and with general management and coaching evaluation, which I don't think anybody else is doing, which I really like. Also, I like Matt Cain's work. I think it's also excellent, especially because he has a little bit of overlap in contract work, which I find interesting. I find it interesting, especially because I don't do any of it myself. And there's always, you always have a soft spot in your heart for somebody who does something complementary to what you do. And after that, on a totally different sort of thematic angle, if you like, I'm very impressed with Ryan Stimson's work recently. He has a passing project, a tracking project, and he has an army of volunteers. And they track passes that leads to shots and categorize them and try to understand what kinds of shots lead to goals, what kinds of sequences are effective and how effective they are. And it's extremely careful, judicious, time-consuming work, which I would never have any patience to do. And it impresses me very much that he does it and does it extremely well. Also, marshalling all those volunteers is itself a great deal of work, which I would consider to be almost Herculean. And the insights that he's getting, you know, anytime you take more data, you're going to find something, but he's taking the time and effort to make sure that he gets not just good quality data, but that he looks at things that he ought to look at, him and his trackers. And I try to not forget, you know, the army of work that he's got going into that. Mm-hmm. So those three people are probably my, you know, I like to joke that if I ever get control of some franchise, the Seattle Unicorns, we joke, or the Flamingos, that will be my little group of people that I'll surround with.
Not a bad list of hires. We actually had all of those people, with the exception of Carolyn. She's coming in a future episode, but Matt and Ryan both on earlier in the show. You can find those episodes in the description down below. I'll make sure those are linked for you. Both of those fantastic episodes and fantastic guys. Incredibly insightful stuff. Let's move on, though, to a little bit of stuff, a little bit of your work, you know, your personal stuff. You've done a lot of work on zone starts, deployment, quality of competition, quality of teammates. Just as a general overview for people who aren't familiar, you know, in a couple of sentences, what did you find when you did your research into zone starts and deployment?
So the the more fully formed work I did was in zone starts. I've done a lot more there. And there I found that the most careful adjustment I could possibly do to try to, you have to make some sort of adjustments so that you can compare what different people do. You know, it's no good to just say, oh, this person has so many zone starts and that person has so many zone starts. Yeah, you have to be able to say, and this is why that person's results are better than that person's results, even after you take into account the fact that they had totally different contexts. And you need better than just this is what you got. Although we'll talk about deployment in a little bit about where the progress is not so strong. So, and what I found is that even people who have colloquially extremely sharp deployment, really exaggerated offensive or defensive zone deployment, when you actually account quantitatively for the kinds of effects that has, you find that it's much smaller, at least than colloquially discussed. So for instance, the Gostad, for instance, had extremely difficult deployment in Nashville over several years. And even then, when you took all of his starts into account, it still only shifted his shot percentages by one percentage point. And he was the most extreme case in the entire league. So 1.2 percentage points, something like this. The enormous bulk of people were shifted by an amount that if it happened in a game, you wouldn't pay the slightest attention to it. So that was a bit surprising to me. And part of it is that the misconceptions come from the fact that people look at the parts of the game that they can control and pretend that those are actually the only parts of the game that they care about, when in fact, very large quantities of the game are being played under conditions that they can't control. And so it doesn't help just to look at the bits that are controlled and say, well, that must be where the coaches are exerting their influence. You need to look at all of the data that you've got to get a handle on exactly what's going on. And so the zone starts were really badly exaggerated, at least in the way that people talk. Now, the quality of competition and deployment, sorry, of teammates and competition is a little bit less fully formed. So, I don't have published adjustments. Some people do. Manny has an adjustment, which I think is good. Dawson Springens has an adjustment, which I don't know as well, but I assume is good. They use slightly different methods than me. And I found that the problem is more fundamental, where you can't even establish a common ground yet before you can, about what it is you're talking about, before you move into evaluations. So for instance, there isn't even a consensus about precisely who is facing the toughest competition and who isn't facing the toughest competition and who is playing with the better line mates and who's not. So I have a strong opinion myself that these things should be measured entirely by ice time. I think anything else opens up to subjectivities, which are unfortunate and which ruin the objectivity of the work that you're trying to do. But plenty of other people say that you should use some sort of other measures to try to measure these things. There's some approaches which only look at certain star players, which is clearly nonsense on its face. You can't be throwing out data if you want to get a total effect. This is a recurring problem. It's the same with the zone starts in a way. Some people say, well, we're going to look at these zone starts. We're going to look at the times when the coaches made decisions. And so you look at some offensive zone shift starts and you look at some defensive zone shift starts. And then you leave out all of the shifts where players start on the fly, which is just deleting data for no particular reason. And the same thing comes up when you look at the quality of competition, where you know to be rigorous, you have to include all of the competition suitably valued. But then when you do this, you find that the distributions of competition are considerably tighter than were previously realized. Then once you have that established, which it's not really the sort of a, I don't want to use the word fight because I'm sort of not that kind of person, but there's an ongoing disagreement with no consensus about exactly how it ought to be measured. And once you decide what it is you're measuring, then you can progress to the, and this is how we're going to adjust for those things. So there's a detailed sort of complicated process there that doesn't have an easy description.
Do you think that's something that we can solve with the data currently available to us? Is there some consensus we could come to using what we have at the moment? Or do you think there's maybe a piece missing that we need more so that we can, take that into consideration as well?
I don't think it's a missing data problem. I think it's more of a matter of a disconnect among the people who are discussing these things about what's important. I have my suspicions about what might cause this disconnect too. there's a handful of effects which I think change the way people think, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse. The most important feature is that the distributions of talent are not symmetric. So if you imagine in your head, this is a little bit nebulous. Pretend if you like that I'm talking about some sort of war stat that I don't really have. If you had some kind of pure talent indicator, you know, whatever that might be, if you imagine a notional distribution of that for NHL players, it's going to have, you know, a big fat bell shape, just like you expect, with lots of players who are good but not great. And then if you look at the two tails of that, you're going to have a bunch of really weak players on the one side, and then you're going to have a bunch of really strong players on the other side. And the strong players, there might not be that many, but they range out a lot more. Among the extremely good players, there's a lot more range than among the really bad players, mostly because there's not a lot of tolerance for really bad players. They get selection biased out pretty fast, especially if you're being paid too much money. There's a strong temptation just to put you on waivers and say, you know, we're done with you. So you have to account for the fact that the distributions aren't symmetric, which is a pain. That's part of why some people focus extra on top competition, because of this asymmetry. The other difficulty that arises is that there's a cognitive bias where humans deal with complexity by imagining that they're only going to consider the stuff that really matters, and they're going to discard all of the rest. There's an implicit weighting function in your head where you take all the stuff that you notice and you say, oh, that must have mattered because I noticed it. You take all the stuff that you didn't notice and you ignore it. And you have to do this because you can't. There's just too much stuff to look at. You can't think about it all at the same time. You can't put it all in one space. Your brain is amazing at doing this. This is why you don't hear the blood that goes past your ears, why the incredible amount of visual input you get, you don't even process. It just sort of just goes straight past you, and your eye picks out the things that you think are important, which is mostly designed for keeping you alive in some evolutionary sense. But it's even broader than that. It has a cognitive psychological sense where you focus on what you think is important at the expense of anything that appears unimportant. So anything that becomes commonplace, you stop noticing, even though commonplace players will still routinely score on you if you make mistakes, which is why people are so keen on having players who don't make large and obvious mistakes. So that tends to shove people towards a methodology which is lopsided, those two factors. And one of those is legitimate and the other one is not. It has to be fought. And that's what creates the problem. And I think the solution to the problem is a social one that will be fixed by people discussing these things and by putting those biases out in the open, that process of science, if you like, for lack of a better word. I don't think there's a specific piece of information that would settle these points. I don't think anybody's saying, oh, you know, if only we had such and such, we would agree. I think it's mostly philosophical differences that are driving that.
And that's fair. I mean, that was a large part of the early workings of the hockey analytics community, was based on philosophical differences, whether it was Corsi versus Fenwick, or like this, time on ice measures versus possession measures for gauging teammates, gauging competition. There's always going to be that disagreement, that perspective, difference of perspective. I think you're right. You know, coming to a point where we can say, no, this is what we're going to look at and this is how we're going to look at it, is going to be the important factor in solving that. With regards to your work specifically, though, on deployment, I know you found a lot of vital information in on-the-fly starts. Was there something there in the work that you did that came out and surprised you, or did you just do this because you were like, because you thought, you know, we're giving up a lot of information and we should be taking this into account?
It was, in some sense, it was there's a natural process that comes out of just being systematic. You know, you talk about these things and then all of a sudden you say, okay, you know what, I'm going to try and figure this out. I'm going to finally put this thing to bed. And then when you sit down, you think, okay, I need to figure out this, and then I need to figure out this. And then you think, okay, I need to find out where all the shifts start. And so then you start writing it down, and then you come up against a shift that's an on-the-fly shift, and then you think, what do I do with this? And then you think, okay, now I have to take a step back, and I have to include that somehow. And then once you do that, then you just carry on just sort of pushing the bubble around the carpet until it pops out. And if you are, so this is part of where it helps to have a scientific background, where I have a physics undergrad, which has been surprisingly helpful to me, that where if you conduct your experiments rigorously without assuming what it is you're going to find ahead of time, and just follow your nose, and every time you come up against a hard decision, you do the thing that you know is the scientifically correct one, then you find yourself very safe in some way. There's a famous line about this, that science is not a path towards truth, but a guard against infinite error. And in some sense, that's a very handy way of thinking of it. It's more like of armor you put on so that you can wade through terrible territory without being killed. And that approach has been, that sort of guiding philosophy has been very useful for me, rather than any kind of, oh, I don't think we're getting a hold of this right now. You know, all those people are saying stupid things. I've got to somehow, you know, show them. It was more of a just, I don't really understand this. It needs a quantitative treatment. I'm going to take care of it. And then from there, you just see where your instincts take you.
Now, I didn't prep you for this question, so it might come across a bit off topic. But on that note, you know, there is a growing rate of privatized analytics companies that I think for the most part are treated with a dose of healthy skepticism just because their work is not in the public and it's not able to be peer reviewed. How important is it that new hockey statistics are out there in the public so that they can be tested by people who are not their creators?
I think it depends entirely on your audience. If you want to work in the public, if you want to have the attention and the respect of the public, then you have to have your data be public. There's no way around it. If you're asking for any kind of recognition, the price is data and methodology and in a sufficiently detailed way that people can check. If you're asking for money, then that's different. You only have to satisfy the people you're asking for money. So I think, you know, there's going to be people who want to try to awkwardly bridge that gap where they want to try to get publicity, which they want to do through the public, but they don't want to give data to the public because then the data would get away from them and they'd lose their competitive advantage. So I'm sympathetic in a way, but at the end of the day, if you want to court the public respect, you have to give the public the only thing that could possibly get you that respect, which is data. So this is, I come from a scientific background where, and then also a mathematical background in addition to that, which is even more open, even more based on, you know, people. I remember people were saying, you know, are you worried that people are going to steal your work? And I was saying, I'm worried that I might have to yell from the hilltops for a decade before anybody listens to me. It's a much more problematic, you know, whereas if you're trying to sell proprietary software, then you have a somewhat different problem. You know, if you let the cat out of the bag for your financial algorithms, for instance, that might be the end for you. So it's, you're the end for you financially, not personally. So I appreciate the difficulties there, but at the end, I'm really not very sympathetic to people who try to gain the public's trust without paying the cost that needs to be paid.
On a different note, you basically grandfathered the hockey data viz movement. What about that was so important for you, that making sure that this information was not only out there and accessible, but it was out there and accessible in a visually appealing way?
This is purely selfish on my part. It has essentially no altruistic components whatsoever. I am extremely bad with numbers. I dislike them. This is part of why I went into mathematics, is because the numbers go away and you can just have symbols. And my PhD was all about doing mathematics with pictures instead of with numbers. And, you know, to make it extremely vague. And so when I was making up my own models, when I was making up my own research purely for my own purposes, I couldn't understand if I was doing what I was doing properly unless I had pictures of it. So I had to make visualizations. And then, again, I was saying before about how, you know, you try to take a disciplined path to make sure that you do everything right. And so one of the ways that I did that was by making sure that every time I did something, I did it for all 30 team. And so I was especially previously, I was interested primarily in the Senators. And so I'd make some chart about the Senators, and then I'd look at it. And I'd say, okay, that's good, and maybe it's correct, and maybe it's not. And one of the ways that I'm going to double check is that I'm going to make it not just for the Senators, but for all 30 teams, and then I'm going to see. And so I discovered that, well, then I have this community of people on Twitter that I talk hockey about. And so, you know, this guy, I think, oh, I'll post this chart about the Islanders. That guy's going to love that, or I'll post this about the Red Wings. So-and-so is going to love that. And they would point out mistakes to me, or they would point out curious things that I hadn't considered, like, oh, it's curious that so-and-so is up there. I would have expected him to be over there. And then I'd go hunt. And sometimes I would find mistakes, and other times I would find something interesting about another team that I didn't know. So all of that work kind of grew on itself for that reason. But the original purpose is purely because I think visually. So there's much less. There's sort of nothing. There was no attempt to think, oh, I'm gonna make a hockey stats website, but I'm not gonna fill it with tables like other people. It was completely different than that.
That's very interesting, and for me, that is just so completely opposite from how I process. And it wasn't really until I saw the viz that was being put out that it became easy to picture and to understand that. You know, like, personally, I have aphantasia, so I can't picture anything in my mind. And so it was only once you started putting viz out like that, once Sean Tierney started putting viz out like that, once Ian Fleming started doing stuff like that, then I was really able to see these numbers in context and get another level of understanding and add, you know, that little bit of, okay, this is kind of the difference between player A and player B in a way that sometimes you just don't get when you're just looking at numbers on a spreadsheet. And so for me, that was such an important step in understanding the work being done in the community. And so I think that movement has been phenomenal and is constantly improving. But what are other ways we can make it better?
I think the main way is just to listen. If you have an audience, every piece of writing that you ever do, every piece of work really that you do has to be pitched to an audience. So I can tolerate, if I make a new viz and there are people who hate it, I can let that roll off my back as long as I know that it's getting through to the people that I want it to get through to. But I take a very broad audience. I want as many people as possible to understand the work that I do. And so I find that the only thing to do is to make sure that you're listening very, very closely to what people tell you to do. And there are some people who are just simply not willing to spend any time to read a chart. It has to be incredibly obvious and immediately, you know, there's sort of nothing to say to such people. The same kind of people who want to look at a piece of text and they want to understand it without actually taking the time to read it. No, you don't, there's no peace to be made with such people, if you like. But other than that, if you take the criticism that you get to heart and feed it back into making a new craft, then you do, over time, you do wind your way into something that's really, really sharp. And that's another thing that's really satisfying about making viz instead of just making tables of data, is that it satisfies an instinct to craftiness, which I think a lot of people have, and I certainly do, where you get to feel like you made something. And if you were clumsy as a kid like me, where you couldn't make anything out of wood or out of metal, the ability to make something out of code and make something, a beautiful little thing, a little gem that you can give to person and say, look, if you put your eyes on this, you will understand something about the sport you enjoy. You know, there's something very, very pleasing in a craft level about that.
That's very fair. I mean, at a certain level, I feel it is part of humanity to have the need to create. And so finding ways to express that through technology about a sport that you're passionate about is, I'm not sure there's a better way to create. You know, finding ways to do it about something you're passionate about. On a personal note, though, you've transitioned into working on a personal note, you've transitioned into working on hockey statistics full time for yourself. Which, how is that going?
Not bad. It's at a tricky kind of between spot right now. I have this Patreon campaign, which is my primary source of hockey income. Lots and lots of people have subscribed, a couple hundred now, which is wonderful. And so it's something like almost $25,000 a year, which is a spectacular amount of money in a way, if you're looking at something that you do for a hobby. But of course, I don't do it for a hobby. I do it for a living, which makes it not nearly as impressive amount of money as I used to make, even as a mathematician, which is not an especially well-paid field. So I'm kind of at a crossroads at it personally. I love it. But it takes an incredible amount of time. It's well over a full-time job. I put in 50 to 55 hours a week. And and it doesn't pay the kind of numbers that I want. So certainly not enough to support me and my family completely, at least not at the same rate for very long. So I'm really actually not at all sure. I'm going to try to find a way to make it through another year. I have enough money to last me through this season, which is great. You know, it's a weird thing to be doing in my early 30s, to be striking out completely on my own. But I'm going to keep on finding ways to scrape through one way or another until the money runs out and I have to go take a boring job somewhere else. I enjoy it too much to not.
I think what we need to do is just get Mark Cuban to buy a hockey team and to start funding you. I mean, that's, you know, the Flamingos. There you go.
If there were a really strong public university culture in this country, which sadly there isn't. I mean, there may have been. People tell me tales about the 70s, which I believe or I don't, depending on the day. You know, I in some sense I feel like my role would be best suited to a university if my job were, you know, professor of math at such and such university, with a specialty in hockey. You know, that would be a great way to live. I don't know if I'll ever get that job. We'll see.
Michael Schuckers has that one, doesn't he? Or no, that's Michael Lopez.
Yeah, I mean, he's a trained statistician too. That he teaches. Well, and I'm a trained mathematician too. I could teach math as well. But it's surprisingly difficult to find such jobs. And I still have a pipe dream of actually working entirely and explicitly directly for the public. That, you know, if I could get the Patreon numbers up to triple or quadruple what they are now, that would cover my server costs and my as well as pancakes for my children, as I like to jokingly call all of my personal expenses. Well, that would be a dream, but it might take a couple of years to get there.
Well, the Patreon will be down in the description below. If you're listening to this and you don't donate to Micah, please consider doing so, because the work you're putting out is fantastic.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, it's always boring to talk money, but let's talk about something else.
That's actually all I've got for you, unless you've got something that's really on your heart that you want to add.
No, it's funny. I've been sort of a little bit quieter on Twitter than I usually am because I've been doing a lot more research. I'm attending three conferences this summer, in the generous definition of summer, between now and the end of the summer. And so I'm working on three simultaneous projects with the hopes of presenting three totally different original pieces of research. So the most interesting one, I'll just give a bit of a teaser about it, is about score effects that's coming up in Vancouver. I'm going to be talking about score effects, about how trailing teams dominate play. It's a matter of a great deal of contention about who is it that causes score effects. Is it the leading team sitting back, or is it the trailing team really pushing? And it turns out that the answer may be neither of those things. It might be the home team.
That's what is like. Interesting.
So we'll find out about, I think I've more or less wrapped that up. You'll have to come to Vancouver or wait until I publish the article based on that talk shortly after Vancouver, which is March 11th. Tickets are sold out, but you can probably try to sweet talk some of the organizers into an extra ticket.
I know previous conferences have been streamed. I'm not sure if Vancouver is.
It has happened in the past. This one is being put on with the partnering with the Canucks themselves.
Wow.
So, and it's actually in the arena. So if anybody has audiovisual facilities, they might well. So there's hope there.
There you go. That, and you know, if this whole thing doesn't work out, you could be a headline writer, because that was a tease and a half.
Well, yeah, I hope to see everybody there.
I will definitely find a way to watch that, or at the very least consume that information once it's out in the public. Micah, thank you so much for joining me. If you guys want to follow him on Twitter, because for some reason you're not already, at Ineffective Math, his website, hockeyviz.com, the Patreon, patreon.com/hockeyviz. Micah, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
No, thank you, Colin.
All right. Have a good one, sir.
You too.
All right, if you like this episode of the Game Time Decision Podcast, you can find me on Twitter at Colton Prell. You can find the show at GTD_podcast. All of our episodes are on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can subscribe to those. You can also find an archive of them on lastwordonhockey.com. We'll be back next week. Until then, have a good one.